Thank you very much for the very kind and flattering introduction. It's a great pleasure for me to come here. It's the first time ever, I'm ashamed to say, in the building. So it is a great pleasure. And thank you to you all for coming out on such a rotten night. I appreciate it very much. I'm going to be talking to you about Chinese medicine, as you've been told. Is there a future for it? And I just want to make it very clear at the beginning that I know nothing of the practice of Chinese medicine at all, but I am interested in, as you will hear, the evolving, the development of Chinese medicine. And as you will see, my main interest is analytical methodology, and you'll see that like many advances in science or in this sort of science, it's the technology the technology that drives what can be done. So just a definition or two to start. Can you see it? Just no, not sorry. So the definition there is about all sorts of Chinese medicine practice, but all of them are claimed to adjust the circulation of qi, which is believed to move around the body in meridians. And it's this qi, the adjustment via a variety of therapeutic techniques, which tries to restore balance to the body. And you can see there I've listed diet and physical training mechanisms, regimens, massage, acupuncture, moxibustion, etc. And just a few pictures. It isn't that massage on a beach. It's this sort of massage. And here is some stimulation using electrodes. Here is acupuncture. And the acupuncturists use the same sort of idea of meridians that I've described. I've just been seeing in the anteroom there some glass cupping instruments, I suppose you would say, which have been used in this country a long time ago. And you can see the application of these cups follow the meridians, as I've indicated there as well. You can have this sort of approach, where there is a little metal disc which is has a combustible element and is burnt, again, following the meridians. And this poor chap is obviously suffering a great deal of angst because he's got a lot of treatment going on. But I'm not going to be talking about that at all. I'm going to be talking about herbal medicines. So when we think in this country of Chinese medicine, that's what we think about. We think about plant medicines available like this. And just a few numbers. TCM industry in China is growing like its gross national product. And it earns $15 billion a year. China exports more than a billion to more than 150 countries. So it's something that China is exceedingly proud of and wants to disseminate worldwide. But it's not an adjuvant to their healthcare system. It's a really robust mainstream part of the healthcare systems. And you can see that there are a good number of hospitals, and they treat many, many patients every year. So it's pretty much accepted as a therapy. And so I just make this point very clear. Historically, the practice of Chinese medicine, you could say, has been experience-based, quite different from what we have at the moment, which is evidence-based. And so what's happening, and I think the thesis that I'll be talking about, is that this transition from the existing experience-based methodology to evidence-based methodology. And I'm going to be talking about some of the approaches that do that. It's not only plants. And so here are some animals preserved. And here are some others. And of course, it gets an exceedingly bad press because of the use of animals and animal parts. But here is a typical pharmacy in China. And you can see these pharmacists, what they're doing. And I'm going to just go here and point on this, because for those of you who don't know it, you can see that there are aluminium trays, which are sort of triangular, and each of them contains a mixture of plant materials, and each one of those represents a daily dose of medicine. And so the pharmacists there are preparing a range, a week's supply, let's say, of a typical medicine. I've mentioned an endangered species. The characteristic feature of prescriptions of Chinese medicines is that they are complex. Rarely are they one plant. Almost never are they one compound. So there are a couple of products now coming through which are more Western approach that have some isolated materials. But classically, the prescription comprises a number of components with these descriptions: tree, fire, earth, metal, and water, with their Chinese names and symbols. And we can describe these, as the Chinese do, as having one main ingredient: the emperor, the king. That's the main biologically active ingredient. And then there are ministers, lesser in potency perhaps, lesser in effect, but they influence the effect of the emperor. And then there are so-called guides. These are there for changing absorption or delivery to the required site. And then the assistants are claimed to reduce side effects. So the principle of a Chinese medicine is by its very nature complex. There are many different ingredients, and that's the point that we have to absolutely understand. So here's a typical prescription. Five ingredients, and you can see that this would be in the aluminium tray. And the way that it's used is that this material is taken, boiled in water, and then strained, and then that's the medicine, drunk throughout the day. Rather unpleasant, often bitter material, but it's the classic way of doing it. So there we go back to that picture, and you can see how they're used. Now, what about TCM in this country? We spend 11 or 14 billion, depending on which paper you read, on pounds on drugs. And as head of a department of pharmacy, I'm very much aware that we have to make sure that our pharmacy graduates understand that 30 to 70% of those medicines which are prescribed and dispensed are not used as directed. Whether it's the dose of antibiotics used incorrectly, not completed, etc., those account for real loss of benefit and, of course, immense waste to the National Health Service. And because people maybe don't take their medicines properly, maybe they find that they are dissatisfied with their Western medicines. And because they've now got money and they've got a bit of education, they turn to all complementary and alternative medicine because of these dissatisfactions. So that's a driver for alternative therapies. Now, what are the diseases that people turn to? Well, they have respiratory conditions, sexual health, gynaecological problems, infertility, skin disease. And, of course, these are conditions which are inadequately and poorly treated by the Western system. So it's no great surprise that those diseases that are of the immune system, for example, difficult to treat, these are the ones that people go and spend on alternative medicines. Now, a few years ago, the Chinese government recognized that there was interest in the West. And throughout the world, so-called traditional Chinese medicine weeks were held. And this is the publicity for the one held in London in August 2008. It was supported immensely by the Chinese embassy. And they brought over antiques and practitioners, and there were scientific meetings and meetings for the public, really to raise awareness of traditional Chinese medicine in the country. And we've got 3,000 clinics in the UK at the moment. And there's a huge, I believe, a differentiator. And I think there are three elements that make the experience of going to a TCM practitioner different from going to a GP. One is that the duration of the consultation is maybe an hour. People obviously derive benefit from that. They are paying for it. That's a big difference. It's not free at the point of delivery. And of course, it's personalized. The consultation is one-to-one, and so is the prescription claimed to be. I'm not absolutely convinced that all prescriptions are one-to-one, but certainly these are three differentiators that people who derive benefit would point to say that that's the difference. But look and make the comparison, as I've just done, with showing you a rather nice Chinese pharmacy and what passes by what people understand for a Chinese medicine clinic here. Nails, beauty, herbs, acupuncture. So there's a huge gap. So what does the regulator think? Not a lot. Because the regulator has been growing up and has been adopting the attitude about herbal medicines of increased regulation and increased control. And I think the MHRA would say if it's registered as a medicine, it's a medicine. And it doesn't matter whether it's a herbal product or what. And so the herbal materials are, if they want to be registered down the same route as conventional drugs, they have to demonstrate efficacy, safety, and quality. If it's a medicine, it's a medicine. So this is what I'm saying about going from the experience base to the evidence base. If there's increased regulation, and we want to build up an evidence base, how can this be done? And I'm going to show you some problems and how we've tried to address them. Now, if you go back, if you're interested in cricket, in 2010, we won the Ashes at Christmas time. And this is a paper on a rather quiet news day, the 30th of December. But so you can see we won the Ashes, blah, 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 hooray. But what did the Independent lead on? Europe bashing again. Europe to ban hundreds of herbal remedies. My point about that is, what illustration did they use? Chinese medicines. And so that's a nice picture. It doesn't show very well on the slide. But there's an attitude of banning and increasing control. As I said, the regulator is interested in this. And so this has driven quite a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last 10 years, and I've got a few things to show you. And if you're not pharmaceutically orientated, this is when you can sleep, and I'll wake you up at the end. Just let me say one or two things that I've just set the scene, and I've established that the medicine is a mixture. But now what's happening is that there are some scientific advances. Some clinical studies demonstrate efficacy, and this rather woolly term that people use and say, Chinese medicine is very important, they synergize with each other. It's becoming a little bit vindicated, and I want to give you an example. And I think I'm going to explain it in some detail because I think it's important. But let's go back a little bit to when I was a student and I studied the British Pharmacopoeia, or at least I bought one. 30 quid. And that was the grant that we had for book allowance. It was £30, and so we had to have one. The BP these days cost £1,000, and so the students don't have to buy them anymore. But if you look at the monograph that the pharmacopoeia described for digitalis, in my day, in the middle 60s, the potency of digitalis leaf was established by a bioassay. You took an extract and you measured the quantity of that extract of the leaf, which just stopped the beating of an isolated guinea pig or pigeon heart. Now, even as a student, you think that's rather cockeyed. You're trying to measure a clinical effect in man by measuring a toxic effect in an unrelated species, a bird even. Wasn't good, but it's all that could be done. Then the chemistry became a little bit more understood, and then chromatography became established, and so the monograph now relates to quantities and peaks of different compounds. But it only goes for one compound, because you can't do a lot using conventional methodology, and it ignores modifying substances in the extract. Another good example of the irrationality of the pharmacopoeia is with valerian. When this was in the first edition of the European Pharmacopoeia, valerian root is a very well-established sedative, and its quality was controlled in the pharmacopoeia by saying that the minimum level of volatile oil was 0.5%. During the 1960s, compounds like that, doesn't matter what they are, they're called valipotriates, these were established. And so the pharmacopoeia, the European pharmacopoeia, said, oh, these are good compounds, and we can easily show whether a sample has these compounds in it, because you can get a good colour reaction. And so they said the presence of these compounds must be demonstrable on thin layer chromatography. Good, sounds great. Well, it's sounding that you're getting into them and you're trying to control the efficacy and the quality of the material. Sadly, during the lifetime of that edition of the pharmacopoeia, these compounds were tested in the laboratory and shown to be mutagenic. And so what was the response of the regulator or the European pharmacopoeia? In the next edition, it said these have got to be absent, which is utterly bizarre. 5 years, you're controlling the presence and demonstrating the presence. The next 5 years, the next edition said they can't be there. And that's convenient because actually they're rather unstable compounds. All you're going to do is heat the extract and they fall apart. But I think it demonstrates the irrationality of trying to look at individual compounds. And here's what I say. This is the driver for me. What is the active? How do we standardize? And now I think it's worthwhile just spending a little time on this very very, very simple scientific experiment, which was published in 2000 only, so it's really quite recent. And the classical way in which these were American natural products chemists, they decided to try and find a new antibacterial agent by going to a berberis. You know, berberis is the rather yellow wood containing plant. And the way you do it, the way you find the active ingredient, is you take the extract and you chromatograph it. And the way you chromatograph it is you take the extract and you put it on top of a column, and some compounds move fast down the column, some move slowly, you put different solvents on, you collect what comes off at the end, and then hopefully you test them all, and hopefully you found the active ingredient. That's the principle. So if we look in a very simple way, here's my diagram, you can see they're putting here's a column, you put something on it, you pass solvent down, you separate it out. So let's look to see what they did. The extract that they made, they tested it, it's an antibacterial, and it had some modest activity. You heard that I worked in the pharmaceutical industry, so 200 micrograms per mil IC50 is actually inactive, but it's got some modest activity. And so what you're really hoping is if when you break it all down into lots and lots of components, you will find many inactive compounds and one really really potent compound that which you can then develop as a drug. And so what they did was they get all these fractions, they tested them, and you can see I've got the answers, I've got the data on here. All of these were inactive, and this fraction D had a little modest activity. Well, that's not what you want. It's what happens frequently. And so when you're doing this work, you say, oh, we've lost it, it's destroyed on the column, we can't find it. But the very simple thing that these workers did, and I emphasize it's recent, 2000, what they did was to test combinations of these fractions. And they tested, as I've written here, A plus B, A plus C, F plus E, etc., etc. They put them back together again and then tested them. And one of the combinations, it doesn't matter what it is, had a magnificently improved effect. Now, that's really startling. It's a trivial experiment, but had never been done properly before. So here's the modest activity compound, which was known to be antibacterial in this berberis. And here is a compound which has no activity at all. But put that together with the known one, you get really a huge increase in activity. And you can see, if you just look at the dose response curve, there's the modestly active alkaloid. Here's the inactive. But when you put them together, you can see this has moved 3 log units more powerful. Now, that was a very significant and important observation. And it led to an understanding and a discovery of multidrug-resistant pump, which led to an understanding of why the plant does it, but it also led to the discovery of antimicrobial modulation for adjuvant therapy, which opened a new era for pharmaceutical discovery. So that's a very important point. But then I ask the question again. If we wanted, not that we would, but if we wanted to standardize the berberis extract, what would we measure? We know berberine doesn't have much activity. We know the thing that we mix it with has got no activity. So you can't really select individual compounds. There's another example which is done by a work in pharmacology in Cambridge, colleagues of mine, ginseng, which is a very well-established Chinese medicine. It's used for immunomodulation, and it's used both for stimulating the immune system and suppressing the immune system. Don't want to go into the details, but just let's have a look at the chemistry of these things. They're horrible, complicated compounds. But these people in Cambridge who study angiogenesis, which means when a tumour metastasizes or starts to grow, it's got to grow. It can only grow to about 1 millimetre or 2 millimetres across, and then it stops because it's got to vascularize or become vascularized. So it attracts blood vessels to it. And so this is the model that they've used in Cambridge. And you can see that those two compounds I told you, one of them is angiogenic, another class is anti-angiogenic. And just let's look at the chemistry. Here, one has got the sugars attached to position 3. Here, the position, the compounds have got sugars at position 6. So they're very similar, but they have opposite effects. And this was taken as an example of really quite interesting justification for the use of ginseng in two different sorts of conditions, because it had both activities. And there's a whole list here of compounds that are well-established, not only Chinese, but European medicines. They're well-established in the clinic, but their mechanism is still largely unknown. So we have problems in standardization. So I think I've explained to you that it's difficult, but what does the pharmacopoeia do? Well, the pharmacopoeia says, do chromatography and see if you can find that peak. And I've been historically rather critical of this approach because here's a plant extract, and it's got, you can see here, this peak, And what the pharmacopoeia says is a good quality sample will have a peak at 3.8 minutes or whatever it is. 6.3 minutes, it doesn't matter what it is. But it's not active. It's not really unique to the plant. So, unfortunately, people have standardized plant extracts on this methodology, using this methodology, and I think, frankly, it gives a sense of false security. Because a patient comes along and said, oh, this one's standardized. That's good. 10 times more expensive than that, but it must be good. But does it mean anything? I don't think it does. So here are some real data for two samples, and you can see they're good. They've got the peak at 6.3 minutes. There's a third one, another point at 6.3 minutes. Here's a fourth one, which has a peak at about 6.3 minutes, but actually it's quite different in profile from the rest. It's different. So if you're a patient and 1 month you get the red one, 1 month the blue one, but it's not good for consistency of product. So then this leads me into what I've been developing or working with others to develop over the last few years, which is this metabolite profiling. So I'm not going to go into the science. I just want to give you the principle of it, because I think I've explained that I don't think you should look at individual compounds to standardize. And the thing about metabolite profiling is that it is non-targeted. You can look to see all the compounds, all those you can detect, and that's the trick. And then you can produce a pattern. Doesn't matter how we do it. You get a pattern like this. It's a very complicated pattern. You can hold it like this, and you put this. It's too complicated to do it. So you have to use statistics to try and separate or find the differences, find the point of differences, or find the point of similarity. And this is a methodology called principal components analysis. And just, if that's rather complicated, let me give you this example, which I think is a really good explanation of what it does. This was published a few years ago, and this painting, which was in the Museum of Dartmouth College in the States, was attributed to Perugino. It's called Madonna and Child. So what did the people do? They took an analysis of the photograph of the painting, and they looked at the nature of the face in each case. And you can see there are five faces there. And they looked at the direction of the brush and the curve that the brushstroke implied, and how much pressure was put on, and the depth of the brushstroke, all these criteria. And then these were quantified, turned into numbers, and then analyzed and compared with each other. And this is the result. You can see that there were four groups. Three of those faces were almost identical as a result of this analysis. But they were different from the other three. So the conclusion from that is there were probably four artists at work. And the point about it is that you don't know what you're measuring. You've looked at the qualities and tried to represent it in a particular way and tried to get some information that you didn't know before. So that's exactly what principal component analysis does for plant extracts. Here are two plant extracts. Actually, they're the same ones that I showed you those chromatograms about. And you can see this pattern is almost identical, except when you just look here. There's a very slight difference there. What does that mean? How can you try to work that? So you do the principal component analysis, you compare these with others, which you set as arbitrarily selected standards. There's another one. And then you get three clusters. And they're different from each other. They're genetically identical, actually, these plants. But they're grown under in different locations, let's say. So you can differentiate them. And then the important thing is that you try to say, this is going to be my standard. This is what I'm saying. And then you put in an unknown sample. And so let's see what happens here. So we've got, this is like our pharmacopoeial monograph. And then you put in a new sample. And I'll just go over here so you can see it. I've changed the colours. But here, The yellow dots represent a plant which came from the same origin as that one, but a year later. And you can see the profile still fits that, and it can be differentiated from these. And here's another one, 2 years later. I've made them red now. It's still going to the same place. 3 years later, it still fits. So at least, if you can present this data in this nice visual way, what you're doing is making your product consistent, and that's what the consumer wants, that's what the regulator wants, consistent product for you to do some clinical studies on, if you're going to get a strong evidence base. So we go away from that, which is, as we've seen, a bit arbitrary, to a better methodology. And the Chinese FDA, State Food and Drug Administration, they're beginning to adopt HPLC profiles for identity. I still have a problem with them, but the idea of generating a fuzzy fingerprint in a way that respects the nature of the Chinese medicine, it's gradually becoming accepted. When you go to get regulatory approval, what the regulator wants is, well, that's all very well, we know what the chemistry is, but how does it work? Is there a mechanism? Is there some biology that you can show? Well, if you don't know what is the active, it's very difficult to measure, select a target, because you don't know what they're about. So you want methods which are analogous to this total chemical approach, which can be useful in understanding the biology. And so we've been putting a lot of effort into doing proteomic analysis. So what does that mean? You take some cells, you grow them in the laboratory, and then you isolate the proteins from them, and you do some electrophoresis, you separate spots. And these are different proteins. And then some other cells you grow in the same way, and you treat them with a drug. And then you isolate those proteins and see whether there's any difference. And here's a clear example where on the one which is treated on the left-hand side has overexpressed a particular protein. Now, that may be a very good target to try to explain the biological activity of the plant material. And there might be many, but at least selecting a couple of those might give you some biological approaches. So that's where we are, and I might show you, if we've got time, some examples of that later on. But I want to show you just very quickly the evidence that we've been able to do with human subjects, obtained with human subjects. This was the first example where plant extract was given to human subjects and using a metabolomic approach, looked to see, did it do anything? So this was human volunteers. They were actually Imperial College PhD students. And they were asked to drink chamomile tea. There's chamomile. So what were they asked to do? So we standardized it. We got some chamomile, 5 grams, made in 200 mils of hot water by infusing for 10 minutes, drink it, and then they provided urine 2 hours after dosing. And so what we didn't do was no purification. There's no targeted analysis here. You can take blood and you can measure something. We're not trying to do that. We're just taking the crude urine. And these are the sorts of data that you get. They're very, very precise, and you can identify components. And so what we were able to do was to do exactly as I've just described with this principal component analysis, which is, this was half a dozen, or this was a dozen students, and so what we were able to do was to average over time, and we can see that you can learn something about the results of what comes out of the metabolomic analysis. Those in the circle, they were rejected because they'd eaten fish the night before, so they had a nitrogen metabolites in their urine, which messed up the analysis. You can distinguish the sexes, not surprisingly. But if we then take the average on day one of those students that we could monitor and see and compare them all with those at the end of the result, you can see that broadly, this is before they drank any chamomile tea, so broadly they're similar. So on day 11, drink the chamomile tea, see what happens. Well, there's a change immediately. The urine profile changes and it stays changed all the time they're drinking the chamomile tea. So then they stop, and because we could, we continued to collect their urine, and so you'd expect it to go back. But it went back slowly. It took 10 days to restore to the normal position. So this is a non-directed analysis approach, and it's really showing that there's a mixture, can have a biological effect, does have a biological effect, and the trajectory analysis shows that we can differentiate these into a number of groups. So we were able to differentiate the treated and the undifferentiated data. And it also demonstrated this prolonged activity of treatment with a herbal product. The benefit, or the change at least, I don't want to say benefit, lasted for some time afterwards. So it's not only these mixtures. I said right at the beginning that there are some Chinese medicines that have led to individual compounds. And here's a story relatively recently in the 1960s when the use of this plant was uncovered by, for the treatment of, or prophylaxis of malaria, was uncovered by the Chinese army, who set up a program to treat malaria. And then it was analysed by WHO. And WHO looked at worldwide. It went to all the embassies in tropical countries that was that figured with were troubled with malaria, and said to each of these embassies, "What antimalarials do you take?" And the country X said this, country Y said that. China said, "Oh, we don't take anything. We just drink this tea." And so this really got people's attention, and the bottom line is, in 1972, this professor, too, isolated this material called artemisinin from the leaves of this wormwood species. It's called Qinghao Su. And this was really shown to be particularly effective. When you look at the structure as a chemist, you look at it and chemists would look at this and say, "Phew, that's impossible, can't develop that. It's so-called an endoperoxide, it's ring structure. It's not accessible. It's not stable enough for clinical use." But actually, it has been developed. And this, like many other drugs from natural compounds, has led to semi-synthetic and improved molecules. And I'll just give you a few examples here. And so you can see great simplification, which has led to a synthetic program to discover new antimalarials. Unfortunately, there's resistance coming. I can't talk to that. And so just last month, Dr. Tu, who is now 85, was awarded the Nobel Prize. There she is with the King of Sweden and the Queen, getting the Nobel Prize in Stockholm. I warned some people before the lecture I was going to be a bit critical. And I am going to be a little bit critical, particularly of some clinical studies. Because if we're trying to get some evidence to show that these things are effective, I think there should be some rigour approach in doing the studies. So if you look at this title of this paper, which was published in a very leading journal, "Effectiveness of a TCM preparation in cough treatment in uncomplicated upper respiratory tract infection." And there's the protocol. So it's randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, between groups, 80 patients, so it's not a bad study. Recruitment has got to have four days' history of cough. They were treated for 5 days, followed up for 6 days, and in the way of doing these studies, the patients do a self-evaluation and also the physician evaluates them. And if you read the paper in the methodology, what is claimed is being evaluated is this massively complicated Chinese formula. And so the conclusion of the study was that there's no difference. And so it's apparently a robust study, published in a very good journal. The data are there for everybody to see. It didn't work. But the trouble about that is, when you look closely, the material that they tested was not what they said they did. It was a proprietary product, which did not contain all of those ingredients. Now, obviously, I can blame who was responsible. The clinicians, they wouldn't think about, when they're doing a clinical study, analysing the material. Why should they? So I just think there should got to be much more rigour in controlling this, because that result, for example, may be erroneous. But it's in the literature now saying that this thing doesn't work. So we've got to think about the test material itself. Oh, sorry, I'm going the wrong way. So we've got to standardise. So there's lots more data coming. This is going, you can use different methodologies, different sorts of things. It all looks very fancy. And they are being applied to drug registrations. And so here is something that I was really amazed, and this is in 2006, so it's now 9.5 years ago. It was the FDA that approved for the first time a plant extract as a drug, a medicinal product. And so the company putting it forward, it actually turns out to be for venereal and perianal warts. And it's a mixture of these products from green tea. Now, the reason that they did it as a mixture was that they're almost impossible to separate. But interestingly, it was the FDA regulatory body that did the first approval as not a herbal medicine, but as a medicine. And this was followed more recently, a couple of years ago, and here is an anti-diarrheal drug from a plant extract. This is a mixture, which is proved for the control of diarrhea in HIV patients, and it's the FDA. Now, what's Europe doing? Well, the Europeans have done something a bit different. There is a new category, and it's called a traditional herbal registration. It means that you can get an approval, not for a medicine, but for a herbal medicine. And the difference here is that there is no requirement to do clinical studies. What is required is that there is a documented history of use over a period, 30 years, much of it in the EU. You do a toxicological evaluation of the literature. You've got to do some chemistry and pharmacy to show that the material is right. And then you get an approved medicine under the traditional herbal registration approach. And so the first one of those was allowed in 2006. And I think the registration documents have to produce a lay summary. And I've just made that yellow so that you can see it, if you can read it. The registration is based exclusively upon evidence of traditional use and not upon data generated from clinical trials. There is no requirement under the traditional herbal registration scheme to prove scientifically that the product works. So what they're interested in is making sure that there's no toxicity or no overt toxicity, and that it is what it says it is. And you can just look, this is how it's done. You apply for a traditional herbal registration. And just look at the numbers. As I said, the first one was in 2006. It started with one. And up till 2012, 193 of these had been granted in the UK. I checked this afternoon. Up till the last data on their website, November 2014, they are now working at 50 a year. So they're growing these traditional herbal remedy approvals. And quite significantly, a couple of years ago, the same approach was used in the Netherlands to register the first Chinese medicine-derived traditional herbal remedy. And it was approved in those. China, as I said right at the beginning, wants, is very proud of its traditions, proud of its technology, its resource. It wants to put these out. And so recently, they created 16 national clinical research bases. Each one has a particular focus on a clinical area, coronary heart disease, stroke, hypertension. And they're spread around, and they're putting in £400 million to do this. And they're spread around all over China. So in order to generate data and good quality clinical data, which might then be able to allow the registration to happen, not down the traditional route, but by another route, the conventional route. And so more and more data are coming, and I'm just going to finish by showing you a little bit something that I think is rather cool, and it's about data mining. To do that, I just want to draw your attention before we do that to the similarities or the dissimilarities of Chinese medicine nomenclature and Western nomenclature. So you can, a practitioner will say, here's qi, we've said that before, there's wind, cold, there's shun, this is to tonify the yin, and this is the Western equivalent, and these are the signs, which of course are similar. So just bear that in mind, there is Chinese nomenclature which has Western equivalents. And so what we were able to do was to build some databases in a particular way so that we could, on the computer, analyze structure with function. That's all we need to say. And so we built these databases. There's ginsenoside I've mentioned before, another one there. And then we could do some virtual screening. I'm not going to say really too much about it, but I just want you to look at the pictures. Each of the columns here is a single compound, a compound that has come from a Chinese medicinal herb. Each of the rows is a different biological target. So we have here protein kinase C, GABA receptor, acetylcholine receptor, things that are, we know, drug molecules interact with. The pattern comes where we have black, there's no activity. The red, the more bright red, shows high activity. And this is, so just gives you a pattern, and this is random ordering of these compounds. And no pattern. No great surprise. When you order the compounds, arrange them by chemical class, we know that similar compounds have similar biological activity. So here's a group, and you can see there's a red line there, which are showing that they're all acetylcholine esterase inhibitors. Now, that's no great surprise, because they're all similar related compounds. We'd expect that. There's another one there. They have a different activity, HIV protease. Since we know plants are related not only by their morphology, but by their secondary plant constituents, if we order the plants, if we order the columns by different plant family, we're not surprised, really, to see that they have the same activity. Patterns emerge. But when you order them by TCM category, and so each one of these plants is described in the Chinese literature as having a particular TCM activity. And so what we've done here is put herbal constituents of, or constituents of herbs in the invigorate blood category. These are different compounds, different from each other. They're not chemically related, but you can see we get a pattern of activity which is rather consistent. So then you say, well, what actually to a practitioner, what do you use these plant medicines for in invigorate blood? Ah, well, they're treating severe pain and ulcer. So let's have a look to see where the activity of these compounds is showing. There's Cox and Lox, anti-inflammatory. There's PKA, important for eradication of Helicobacter pylori, ulceration, and pain channels or sodium channels treating inflammatory pain. So I think this is really quite striking that these unrelated compounds can be linked, their activities can be linked by our Western terminology. So what we're doing at the moment is really trying to exploit that approach by looking at medicines with complex etiologies, like anti-inflammatories. Can we get some understanding in more detail of multi-target TCMs that might have help in diseases of complex etiology? So you heard at the beginning, we've started this very modest Centre for Natural Medicines Research at the college. Funding is a hell of a problem. It's very difficult. But we're very lucky because at King's we have this King's Health Partners, so we can work and do work with clinicians. We've got some money from different sources. And as a result of this investigation that many of the scientists in Europe and China, and there are some in the audience, got together over the last few years to get to form an association to promote good practice. And many of the problems that I've highlighted have come out from the analysis of this good practice, and we have this research association, which is there to try to promote improved quality work, and it was published a few years ago in several issues of the Journal of Pharmacology. So I just at the end wanted to thank my computer design colleagues, because I couldn't do that. I knew what I wanted to show, but they did it for me, so Dr. Barlow and Dr. Ehrman are very instrumental in putting that together. But I wanted to finish by coming back to my starting slide. I asked a question in the title. Is there a future? Well, I think it can have a future. I think there's, with emerging technologies, we can establish evidence. So we don't have to believe in it, we don't have to believe in Chinese medicine, the evidence will speak for itself. However, if that's the case, it can have a future, but we just have to do the work properly. Thank you very much for listening.